are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 7th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, senior labor reporter for the Payday Report, Mike Elk. On the West Virginia teachers strike, the victorious West Virginia teachers strike. Meanwhile, back in Washington, Gary Cohn finally finds an excuse to quit after he was not named Fed chair. And the DCCC takes it on the chin in Texas. Runoffs to follow. Stormy Daniels sues Trump to ditch that NDA. The question is, why does Trump care anymore? Elaine Chao admits that Donald Trump killed the crucial New York City tunnel project. Dems introduce a partial tax repeal infrastructure plan. Andrew Cuomo gets a Democratic challenger. Among other things, Kellyanne Conway violated the Hatch Act. Trump administration sues California over its laws to protect immigrants, and a UAE advisor is cooperating with a special counsel. All this super tough. Sorry, Jared. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, on today's program. I should tell you right off that today is a special day for me. 5 years ago, I guess it's really 4 years, 364 and, I don't know, 7 hours ago. Saul A. Cedar was, popped out. He didn't quite pop out. He was shoved out. By his mom. It is his birthday. He was born. How did you think it worked?
It's all news to me. Don't forget I was homeschooled.
There you go. And he was born. It is his birthday today. It is, he is 5 years old. And pretty exciting for everybody involved around the Cedar household. So happy birthday to Saul. Just wanted to get that out there. Not that he listens to the show.
Maybe someday.
Maybe someday. Maybe someday he'll be hosting it. I don't know if he can get Mila to give up the seat. Maybe they'll be co-hosting. I don't know. I really don't. I really doubt any of it. Folks, also, I want to just correct one thing from yesterday. We got a call later in the show in reference to Connor Lamb. He is the Democratic nominee in a March 13th special election. That's 1 week from yesterday. It's in Southwest Pennsylvania. I've been told that part of it, it involves Pittsburgh by Mike from PA. And he did say he is not the best on gun control, without a doubt. At a debate in the wake of the Parkland shooting, Lamb had said, I guess in a Q&A with reporters afterwards, that he favored stricter background checks but wasn't sold on other new gun laws. Unclear what that is, but, you know, not necessarily the position you want taken if you're in New York State, or I should say in New York City. There's obviously a lot of politicians upstate who are not as good on guns as I would like them to be. Kirsten Gillibrand, when she was the congresswoman from the 20th District of New York, which was my voting district, not good on guns. And guns were just as lethal at that time. But be that as it may, we got a call saying that he was so aggressive on guns that he sent out a mailer. Pictured here, thank you, Connor Lamb, for opposing gun restrictions. Supports our Second Amendment rights. He says new gun laws aren't at the answer. Opposes a ban on high-capacity ammunition magazine for assault rifles. I don't know if he has articulated that position, but that mailer is not from him. That mailer is not from him. It is actually a mailer that was put out by the Congressional Leadership Fund, a super PAC aligned with House Speaker Paul Ryan that has spent millions of dollars on the race. That is a mailer that's being sent out to obviously dampen Democratic enthusiasm for Connor Lamb. Just a thought you should be aware. Doesn't mean that if you live in that district, you should be enthused. You have a better sense of how important his position on guns are, but just wanted that out there.
Are the Russians doing this?
Of course.
Okay. It's not just Republicans doing this sort of thing.
Of course.
We'll do this.
Meanwhile, last night, big story in Texas, of course, came in regards to the Moser race where the DCCC there, I guess, sort of one of their backed candidates, I think, came in like fourth, right? I mean, or was the other candidate? They wanted two candidates. Presuming that there wouldn't be a runoff, and only one of them came through. So Moser, we'll talk more about that in a bit. But in the primary for the Texas Senate race, Beto O'Rourke won handily, and Ted Cruz has already put out his first ad against Beto O'Rourke. It's pretty special.
If you're gonna run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man, because liberal thought is not the spirit of a Lone Star man.
Pause it. Should also say, you can't be a liberal
awesome.
Woman. I mean, you probably can't even be a woman.
Man with man? That's some real songwriting there.
Have they ever had a female senator?
Yes. Kay Bailey Hutchinson.
Okay.
Because liberal thought is not the spirit of a Lone Star man. You gotta be tough as Texas and honest about your plans. If you're gonna run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man.
I remember reading stories, liberal Robert wanted to fit in. So he changed his name to Beto. Hit it with a grin. Beto wants those open borders.
Oh, wait, pause it. Wait. Can we go back a little bit on that? What's that line?
Saying basically that Beto changed his name.
And what was the, what was he trying to, just roll back a little bit. He's trying to fit in. Yeah. Let's just go back a little bit. Let's play.
I remember reading stories. Liberal Robert wanted to fit in. So he changed his name to Beto and hit it with a grin.
Pause it. So he wanted, little Robert, wanted to fit in. And so he changed it to Beto because he wanted to fit in. Like he's hiding something.
With the other Beta cucks, probably.
Let's go.
Choose. Hit it with a grin. Beto wants those open borders and he wants to take our guns. Not a chance on earth you'll get a vote from millions of Texans.
If you're gonna run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man.
I'm Ted Cruz, and I approve this message.
Ooh, all of a sudden it got a lot less cool.
I got to say, Ted Cruz making a very smart choice by not featuring himself in an ad. I think anytime you cannot show Ted Cruz in trying to promote Ted Cruz has got to be...
Raphael Edward Cruz also is his original name.
What?
Ted, you must change our name.
I wonder how that... and we got to work on rhymes for that. His name was Raphael, and it changed it to Ted.
He looked like a serial killer from Silence of the Lambs. Just gratuitous.
Right. We're not...
One of the most disturbing people to ever appear in public.
Hey, that was a good urban legend about Ted Cruz being the Zodiac Killer.
I prefer the JFK stuff.
Yeah. The whole thing is crazy. I never said anything about the wife. In a 48-hour span, Donald Trump tweeted out a picture, retweeted a picture of Ted Cruz's wife and on one side, and then Melania on the other, and then the next day, then accused
naked
Ted,
Melania on the
naked
other.
Naked Melania, and then accused Ted Cruz's dad of killing JFK.
And Ted Cruz endorsed him
later
that week.
Ted Cruz endorsed him like a cuck.
Well, it took a week.
Simpler times.
I do remember that video that he shot where he was like talking right into the camera, like, "You coward! You'll never." And just give me another 6 weeks, and we'll steer the ship correctly. He's in big trouble, I think. Ted Cruz. I think he's going to have a real challenge here. In the meantime, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Mike Elk about the strike in West Virginia and the implications for the union movement going forward. And also, I should say, we're now seeing reports that Arizona teachers are contemplating a strike inspired by what's going on in West Virginia. So this could get interesting, folks. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Payday senior labor reporter and writer for The Guardian newspaper, Mike Elk, from the Payday Report. And you can check that out at paydayreport.com. And I should say, full disclosure, I'm a subscriber. So, you know, but that won't bias my interview whatsoever, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Great to have you on the show, and thanks for being a subscriber. You know, we rely on readers' contributions to do the kind of reporting we just did in West Virginia, where we did 13 dispatches more than any other rival national publication of our scale.
And
so, you know, we rely on reader donations to do that. So appreciate you subscribing.
My pleasure, and I appreciate the work you're doing. And it has been fascinating to see how, I mean, this is a, all right, well, let's just start with this before we talk about the implications of it. Just give us the, what led up to this strike and put it in historical context for us.
Well, I think what led up to this strike was a severe crisis of austerity in the state of West Virginia. Someone was just saying, you know, when they settled a similar strike in 1990, the teachers got a $5,000 raise. This time around, they got a $2,200 raise. So that gives you a sense of the sort of scale of what's happening. In West Virginia, public employees don't have collective bargaining rights. So over the last several decades, as the coal industry has bottomed out, and the economy has, you know, gone into the tanks in West Virginia, and Republicans have taken over and cut big budgets, we've seen, teachers' salaries not keep up there. Teacher salary in West Virginia are currently rated 48th out of 50 in the U.S. You have some teachers, when you factor in health insurance, that are making less than $15 an hour when they start. So all these things really factored into what happened here in West Virginia.
And so this was the strike itself, my understanding, was unlawful. Can you talk about what the distinction is between it being unlawful and illegal, and what were the implications of that as the strike went on?
Well, I'm not really sure what the implications are beyond semantics of the two words. At any time, some of the school districts could have sought an injunction against the strikers since it was unlawful, but they never chose to do that. As a result of that, you know, the strike was able to go on for 9 days, and they won a good chunk of their demands as well as progress towards achieving their other demands.
Why do you think the school district didn't issue that injunction?
I think part of it was how much support the teachers had behind them in terms of community support. When I was down in West Virginia, people were stopping by all the time, dropping off food, honking the horn, telling people to keep going. And so, how do you go into court and get an injunction to order teachers back? Are you going to go around to teachers' houses and arrest them if they don't teach school?
Right.
The state of West Virginia already has 700 vacancies. So how are you going to bring in scabs in a state like that? So I think to call for arrests of these folks would have politically backfired very quickly. I mean, the paddy wagons full of teachers being arrested, that kind of thing.
And that's interesting because I guess with that many vacancies, that gave the teachers that much more leverage in the context of the strike.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of teachers I talk to, part of the problem is if you look at some of the rural southern counties, the majority of students there, when they go to college, have to take remedial classes. Some of this is due to the high turnover in these classrooms. You know, we see classrooms in West Virginia where sometimes people have four different teachers in 1 year.
Wow.
So, it really hurts the economy. And I think people in West Virginia know that it's not the teacher's fault. They know how hard it is to retain people. They see how often they have, their own kids go into classrooms that are essentially being monitored by a teacher's aide because they can't find a teacher. So, I think people have experienced the problem of the teaching shortage and the low pay on a very personal level, and I think they were able to get support because of that.
Based upon conversations I had about the Chicago teachers' strike, right, from, I guess now 5 years ago, maybe it was, my understanding is that the Chicago Teachers Union was consciously building relationships in the community both in anticipation of the possibility of a strike, but to broadly make, I mean, as part of a social union movement as opposed to the managerial model. Was any of that going on in West Virginia? Did you talk to any of the teachers? And I should say, as a subsidiary question, what is the union leadership like? Because we we saw them make a deal, I guess it was a week ago, and basically their rank and file said, no, we're not taking that deal.
Well, I think it's a complex question, both of these questions. The first part about community support is it was very widespread. A part of this was that, you know, a lot of these teachers are already very heavily involved in the community and involved in community organizations. And there's been an effort underway, you know, really over the last decade as teachers' unions have been under attack to make a lot more community engagement. And I think those efforts have accelerated as unions face the threat of the Janus case, which would take away agency fees, the ability to collect dues off of everybody in a bargaining unit. So we've seen a lot of that. And during the strike, we saw, you know, food drives for students, daycare sent up. You know, the teachers really went out of their way to make sure that they could help provide for students during the strike. The second part of the question is, you know, it's tough for me to really gauge what the leadership is like and what kind of deal they cut. Part of their thinking here was there was a deep fear always of having an injunction placed on them. An injunction can mean that you round up teachers, but it also means you can sue a union and bankrupt that union. So part of the reason they were so quick to cut a deal was that they were scared an injunction could come down at any time. So I think they cut a deal, and then when they got pushback from their membership, they went back to the table. You know, it's not really clear to me what happened beyond that point, but it was clear, you know, since it happened in so many different counties, but it was clear that a lot of people in a lot of different counties weren't willing to take that deal. And I think by going back out, they presented even more fear because a union leader can go to the bargaining table and say, hey, I don't even know if I can get my members to accept this. So they really, by going back out again, were able to push this, you know, 5% raise for all public employees.
I mean, that seems to me to be a fairly decent negotiating tactic. Right. I mean, I don't know how you can manage that on a planned basis. But the idea that you're that leadership can head back to the table and say, look, we just we can't force our members to take something that they all sort of. I mean, there's a consistency between the members pushing back on the leadership and just the concept of a wildcat strike in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, and also from a legal standpoint, the union had met its obligation as union leaders to end the strike at that point. So they were really outside of legal risk. And I think at that point, the union was willing to support this going on for much longer. And I think they showed a lot of strength, and I think it's going to have ripple effects. The Oklahoma Education Association, for instance, did a survey of its 10,000 members. To see if they were interested in striking, and 80% of them said they were interested in striking this year. In Pittsburgh, for instance, they were negotiating a teachers union contract while this was going on, and Pittsburgh is only about 45 minutes from West Virginia, where I live in Pittsburgh, and we share a media market with West Virginia. So there was a lot of coverage here in the Pittsburgh media market of the West Virginia teacher strike, and what winded up happening is that, you know, last Monday, not this Monday, but last week, teachers in Pittsburgh voted to strike, and they gave 96 hours notice. Within 2 days, the school district had folded because they didn't want a repeat of what was happening in West Virginia.
Interesting.
So, you know, this is going to have ripple effects for a very long time, just as I think you're right, the Chicago teachers strike had a lot of ripples effects in terms of the militancy of that union. Because, you know, you have to remember the early Obama years, right? Obama was pushing charter schools, merit pay, all these things to hurt teachers' unions. And that Chicago teacher strike was really the first time in a big way that that union pushed back against the Democratic Party. And now we're seeing just not pushing back against the Democratic Party, but being willing to break the law and take on people, you know, in the Republican Party as well as other parties. And I think now with the current dynamic versus Trump, I think you're going to see a lot more willingness of public unions that are under attack to do this sort of thing.
Yeah, I want to circle back to that in a moment, and also just note that particularly relevant about that Chicago teacher strike was that Arnie Duncan was the superintendent of the schools who went on to be the Secretary of Education for the Obama administration. So there was a real, direct rejection of all that Arne Duncan and the Obama administration represented. But I want to just also highlight what you'd mentioned about the teachers and their relationship with the community. They had food drives. You just mentioned it briefly, but I want to just have you just give us a little bit a better sense of that. They had food drives for students, and as well as providing daycare, and the food drives for students, of course, is really important because there's a lot of students who will go without a breakfast and a lunch if it wasn't for school on a daily basis. And I imagine the number of free lunch students in West Virginia in certain areas is very high.
Oh yes,
I mean we.
Yes, I mean a lot of. Did you see, teachers told me stories of paying bills for their students, you know, over the years. That there wasn't anything they wouldn't do, but at a certain point, you know, push comes to shove, and you know, you gotta, you know, it's like the fireman's rule, right? You gotta take care of yourself before you can take care of anyone else. And if you can't pay your bills, how are you supposed to teach, you know?
Right. And so, I mean, let us, all right, well, so what was it that was ultimately the deal that the teachers were able to wrangle from the state?
So they were able to get a 5% raise. In addition, the governor vowed to veto any bills taking away seniority rights for teachers, promoting charter schools, promoting alternative teacher certification, as well as any bills, you know, eliminating dues checkoff for political contributions for union members. So they defeated all those anti-union legislation as well. In addition, the governor agreed to freeze all out-of-pocket health insurance costs for 19 months for the teachers. In the interim period, they have set up a task force to present recommendations on how to fix the state health insurance plan. This task force is set to give its report in early October before the state legislature reconvenes. So if the state legislature at that time doesn't vote to fix PEIA, then it'll be a big election issue. And I think the union's really fired up for the election. So while they couldn't win all the long-term health insurance issues they wanted, you know, they did fix it for 19 months. Ultimately, you know, fixing this PEIA health insurance issue, the state health insurance program, is going to require taxing frackers more, which is what the governor of the state has proposed and the Republicans in the legislature have voted against. So really, I mean, this comes down to, you know, do you want to tax frackers more or pay teachers more?
And am I correct? And my understanding is that they secured a 5% raise, not just for themselves, but for all state workers.
Yeah. Which was more than they had initially set out to do. So this was a big victory because, you know, they got a lot of solidarity from other state workers. And at a certain point, you know, there started to be high call-off rates of state workers who were going to rallies. And there was talk among other state workers' unions of maybe striking in solidarity in wildcat strikes. So I think, you know, initially that wasn't on the table to match the public employees. But as this process got going, they were able to throw that on the table.
That seems pretty... That seems pretty amazing to me. I mean, is that something that has happened that occurs on a fairly regular basis where you have one public sector union strikes and they end up getting raises for every other public sector worker?
I mean, I'm not an expert. I mean, I'm sure it's happened, but it's not something you hear about all the time. And it's important to remember that this was happening in the context of them not having collective bargaining.
Right.
So typically when people are negotiating contracts, it happens in a collective bargaining situation where you have one contract for one group of workers and you can't, you know, you can coordinate to some degree, but you can't do that. In this context, since they didn't have collective bargaining rights, it was about, you know, basically striking to force the legislature. And we see unions do this in other states in the South. And I think what this strike really showed is you have this Janus case coming down now. And I think what it showed is, hey, you can take away certain union rights and still, you know, have a strong union on the shop floor, like you saw in West Virginia, where they don't even have collective bargaining rights.
I want to circle back to that in a second, too. But in terms of the funding for the raises, it was reported yesterday, or I saw it, that the local West Virginia reporter said that the Senate Well, the president of the Senate said that he anticipates the money coming out of Medicaid and perhaps other budget cuts. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so it's projected from the governor that they should get $58 million more in revenue. Some of that revenue is coming from cuts to the state tourism budget as well as the economic development budget. However, if they don't meet those revenues, something like $20 million might come out of Medicaid from the state. It's not clear at this point. Those are potential cuts if this projected revenue isn't met. So, you know, it is kind of a draconian situation in that respect.
And what's the union's perspective on that? Have you heard any word as to what their perspective is on that?
Well, a lot of what was cut was corporate welfare programs. So we're talking about, you know, running ads on TV saying, you know, promoting West Virginia tourism and, you know, giving away corporate tax cuts. There's only about $20 million, and the governor really says it's about $10 million cuts to Medicaid that might go into effect if these revenues aren't met, right. These revenue projections aren't met. So, I mean, essentially they're kicking the can down the road, and the union's perspective is they're certainly going to fight those cuts if they come down.
All right. Well, let's talk about the broader implications of this. I mean, you mentioned Oklahoma. I saw a piece today that that said teachers in Arizona now are contemplating a strike and have cited what's gone on in West Virginia. If other unions across the country are anticipating what's going to happen with Janus, and that they're going to be they're going to have a lot of and there's subsidiary complications to as Janus we'll see what happens as it's ruled on, but assuming that they're going to be stripped of agency fees, but for those people who want to voluntarily pay them, like if they were emulating what went on in West Virginia, how would they go about doing it? Is it just simply the membership has just got to decide to go walk off, or was there some sort of like larger plan that led up to this moment?
Well, I think, you know, there was a larger plan that led up to this moment. They had been talking about this for some time. And also you have to consider West Virginia history, which is that there is a history of mass scale walkouts in 1990. All the teachers walked out on strike. In 1969, over 40,000 coal miners went on a legal wildcat strike for black lung benefits. So there is a history of this in West Virginia that runs very deep that they were able to draw on. Some of these other states, there's not quite the same type of history where people have that, you know, fond memory of militancy. But that's not to say that it won't happen. There obviously has to be a fair amount of planning. There's a fair amount of planning laid here. But at the same time, when you look at a result, when 80% of teachers in Oklahoma say they want to strike and they go out and do it, you know, that does say something, you know, if they go out and pull that off, you know, because when people get involved in a strike is when they really learn what a strike's like. I mean, it's, you know, I've been involved. I've covered labor disputes. I was also a shop steward at Politico and was legally fired in the union drive. You know, you can theorize about labor, you know, struggles, but until you actually get involved in one and you're faced with the daily crises of maintaining a picket line and maintaining strength on a picket line, all that planning means very little until you get to that point, because that's when people really start to find out what they're made of.
I mean, what on the ground, like what did that look like? I mean, maintaining that that picket line.
Well, I think it was tough. And I think part of the reason they wanted to go back in is when you get beyond about 2 weeks, you know, the first week of the picket line, everybody's all excited. You know, they're out banging drums. They're out dancing. People are dropping off food. You know, everybody's having a good time. They're taking time off work. People are shooting shit. And that first week on a picket line is always a lot of fun. But when you start getting into that second week, you know, that people don't quite have the same energy to be standing outside, you know, shouting the same chants as they always do. You know, people, you know, so, you know, there was a battle to maintain morale. And, you know, I think they were able to pull it off to a large degree. You know, obviously it wasn't as much energy as the early days, But as, you know, maintaining a strike for a long period of time, you know, look, I've covered lockouts that go on for 14 months. After 14 months, picket line duty becomes sitting in a, you know, like a lawn chair.
Right.
On a picket line, you know, with some signs. You know, so I think part of the calculus here and going back in is how much longer can you maintain? And it's better at this point to bring the union back in without having the strike being broken than to keep going when you still keep the risk of potentially striking again in October or at some other date if you don't get the changes to PEIA that they want. And this is important to bring up. Under traditional union contract, if you strike in the middle of the union contract, that's illegal. You could be fined a ton of money under the National Labor Relations Act. But since they don't have a union contract, they're in a bit more of a gray area. They can strike whenever they want.
Huh. That's interesting. So the absence of some of the protections that one would get as a union also, I guess, don't constrain them in the same way. Let me ask you this.
For instance, and let me bring this up.
Please.
In October, the beginning of October, this task force set up by the state, including teachers union representatives, will present its plan on how to fix the state health insurance program, PEIA. If that doesn't get voted on or isn't moving in the state legislature, you know, teachers could go out on strike again to force the issue in the media right before the election. So, you know, it is maintaining that sense of strike and not wanting to drag this out longer and risk an injunction when you might not get much more from the state legislature, which is an important dynamic here.
I mean, bring up the election. I mean, how do you square this this history of union militancy? How do you square the success of this strike with the fact that West Virginia is, you know, basically is Trump country? Democrats, I think, not since Mike Dukakis have won in that state. What accounts for that? If you have a sense,
they actually haven't won in the state since NAFTA. And I would say NAFTA and other deals like that played a large role in it. You know, the decline of those places, because there was a coalition there for a long time of union populist voters. And when the Democratic Party started getting away from its populist message, when the message started to become, well, you can get job retraining, blah, 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 you know, people got really turned off in those parts, particularly given the fact that at the same time that jobs were leaving, you know, evangelicalism was sneaking in more and more. And there really has been a rise in evangelicalism in these areas as times get more desperate. So you're seeing that dynamic. But I also think, you know, you do have to ask, you know, there's been racism in those areas and racism in the past, but also the willingness of certain groups of actors to play off that racism. I mean, in the 90s, we really changed the conversations of the Democratic Party from economic populism to vilifying black people and locking them up at record rates. And so, you know, what sense did that make for the Democratic Party in a place like West Virginia to get into a debate about who's going to lock up more black people and just abandon all the economic populism, right? It didn't really serve the interests too well to create a more racist conversation while taking away the populist conversation. And so you see weird things there. I mean, you have this guy, Richard Ojeda, who's running for Congress, who's become this viral internet star. And I really refer to Richard Ojeda as the George Wallace of West Virginia. I mean, that's the kind of ambition he has and the kind of bullshitter he is. I mean, this is a guy who told the New Yorker, Ojeda, you know, he's a state senator, told the New Yorker when he was running for state senate 2 years ago that he voted for Trump as a Democrat because he was tired of, quote, illegal aliens coming here and taking all the benefits. You know, just promoting these outright lies that undocumented workers can even get access to government benefits. I mean, here you have someone doubling down on the racism and trying to present the economic populism. So I think this is an opening. I think it's an opening for the movement to start talking about issues of race. But we have to be careful who are the leaders, you know, like this Richard Ojeda guy who's, you know, gotten a big profile in Politico and all these other places. You know, they mentioned that he might have voted for Trump and, oh, he feels bad about it. But, you know, just a year and a half ago, he was giving racist comments to the New Yorker about how, you know, he didn't think immigrants should get benefits. You know, that's one thing if you're an average voter, but if you want to run for Congress and paint yourself as a hero, and should be given this guy's videos, they went really viral during this as a state senator. You know, his videos were getting 200,000-300,000 views. And this guy, you know, sort of launched himself into the national media spotlight, tried to. But, you know, there among some of the progressive types on the left, he's still seen as a charlatan because he's willing to say this race baiting shit about Mexicans.
Interesting.
So it brings up some interesting threads. And I bring up the immigration standpoint because I do feel that immigration is the Selma issue of our times. It is the civil rights issue of our times. And we've seen too many people in these Rust Belt districts run away from immigration right here in Pennsylvania. In PA 18, the special election that's happening next week, the Democrat won't talk about immigration at all. He calls for more border security, which we just know is just racist language and bullshit.
And I mean, and so and is Ojeda, is he's been also championing this strike, too. Is that right?
Yeah.
So there are.
Have you seen much about this guy? There was a huge profile in Politico magazine.
Now that you mention him, I remember. And he also, there was some weird thing where he got beat up before the last election or something.
Yeah.
Am I imagining that? Like, I remember this guy.
That happened. He got beat up by a guy.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why that sticks in my mind, but it's just, it was a weird story. And he was, yes, his name pops up from time to time. I mean, I guess that is the sort of. The dichotomy in these areas, and you're talking about Connor Lamb, right? Is the special election for in next week in I guess around your parts there. Well, all right. So let me ask you this: how much of what's going on with this union? Because there's another phenomenon that's happening in the wake of the 2016 election. How much of what's going on with the union is a function of Trump? I think you touched on that a little bit. But how much is also going on because we're talking about a union that is, I don't know, you tell me, but I would imagine somewhere around 90% female, maybe more. And we have this sort of other story that is run parallel to this, which is that when you look at the data across, particularly in places like Pennsylvania, but also in Georgia, and I would imagine other states, women, more often than not, college educated white women, but women in general have become far more activated in this era. In terms of politics, how much of that was at play here?
You know, I think that's a really excellent point you bring up. And I think it's to a lot of the intersectionality of these issues that I think go unnoticed, which is that, you know, women have really gotten it the hardest under Trump. And I think, you know, have been pushing back. You know, you see the Me Too movement emerging. You see all these different movements, the Women's March, et cetera. And, you know, certainly this had some impact on that. Some of the women I talked to had gone to the Women's March. So certainly that new level of militancy among women had a big impact on this. To what level, I can't really say with any conclusivity, but it's certainly a big role and a trend to watch in.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if we do start to see this type of labor action in Oklahoma amongst the teachers there and in Arizona as being reported. And it is, you know, worth noting that when you look at the most militant of union activity across the country, it seems to be coming from unions that are dominated by women. You know, nurses union has been yep. very aggressive, and the teachers unions have been, as far as I can tell, over the past couple of years, the most aggressive of unions, you know, in general. And those two professions too are ones where they have a lot more opportunity, it seems to me, to interact with their clients, right? I mean, you've got people who are well situated in the context of medicine as nurses and as teachers to interact with the community.
There's a lot of emotional labor that goes into this, right? and the kind of respect that that emotional labor has in the community in terms of, you know, everyone has a story of someone in the medical profession who helped them, or everyone has a story of someone in the teaching profession that helped them. You know, when a bunch of ball bearing workers go out on strike at a plant, nobody thinks, oh, God, those ball bearing workers, we really need them to keep those airplanes up in the sky, you know. But I think there is a direct connection. And I think the role of women in being able to draw on those kind of partnerships and realize the intersectionality, because, you know, white men are very bad at doing this type of intersectional organizing, horrifically bad. You know, some during the Bernie campaign and that Jacobin crowd and those other places would say, oh, well, intersectionality is not even a thing. We all just need to be united along class lines. And clearly that's not the space from which people organize. People organize from a bunch of different spaces, from a bunch of different feelings of oppression they've experienced, whether around race, class, gender, disability, sexual orientation. You know, people organize from these perspectives, and we have to always have a multi intersectional approach to these things.
Well, Mike Elk, really appreciate the reporting you were doing from West Virginia and the work that you guys are doing over at the Payday Report. People can check it out at paydayreport.com. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half, wherein we will be we're going to be playing... playing a little bit more Ted Cruz-ness and talking about the results from Texas. The numbers are really good. They seem to have held up fairly well relative to the early voting numbers, which were pretty stunning. Still, obviously, have more Republicans in Texas, and in the context of a primary, you would anticipate more Republicans coming out than Democrats, like I say, because you have a lot more Republicans there. But the rate of increase of participation among Democrats relative to Republicans in that primary is could very well be a lot more telling. I will also say this. It does not appear, though, that the increase in early voting was matched, which suggests that maybe there was also sort of like a quality of what I had mentioned yesterday to John from San Antonio, that there was deep enthusiasm, but not necessarily wide enthusiasm. But again, general election coming up, and we'll see. But also fascinating that the DCCC candidates, the ones who, or and I should say also more specifically perhaps, those candidates who had the most money didn't necessarily win. And so to the extent that people look to pull lessons out of this, it's going to be, and this is really more relevant, and I hate to put it in the negative, but it's going to be a lot harder for people who want to impose a narrative that is disingenuous about ideology or about money. It's going to be a lot harder for them to impose that narrative on this. And that is a healthy thing for folks from who share that perspective of, you know, you shouldn't choose a candidate based upon their willingness to pay consultant friends of yours. I mean, if the goal is to win an election, because that's not necessarily, there's not a one-to-one relationship between people who are willing to pay your friends and win an election, apparently. And it comes
really
as a shock.
It's too bad that isn't totally synchronized.
I mean, it is, however, a ironclad rule of podcasting.
Yep.
Yeah. If your friends are not supporting the show, folks, find new friends.
Doing something wrong.
But you can be one of those people who support the show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And in by doing so, you support the free daily show. Tomorrow we will have Professor Richard Wolff on the program by popular demand and also unpopular demand. And when you become a member, we say thank you by giving you an extra hour plus of programming every day. And if you want access to that, but don't have the financial means, by all means, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up. Don't forget, you can check out last night's TMBS on our YouTube page, or subscribe always. You should do via iTunes. Who was on last night, Michael?
Natalie Shore and Nomiki Konst.
Natalie Shore and Nomiki Konst. And Jamie has a new thing up at her Patreon page, which is patreon.com/JamiePeck. And if you want to somehow feel emotionally closer to Matt Leck, go check out...
Good luck.
Go on Spotify and find the Majority Report playlist. Also, you know, the podcast is available on Spotify, too, the free podcast.
I'll tweet out the playlist.
You'll tweet out the playlist?
From the Majority Report thing this afternoon.
So that's a great way to feel just a little bit closer to Matt and not make him get all freaked out about he's being crowded or he needs his space because he's not aware that you'll be there. So... All right, 646-257-3920. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We had no mid-roll today, right?
No.
Okay, good. All right, folks, see you in the fun app.
Oh,